This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 22, 2002. I'm Larry Bensky, sitting in for Verna Avery Brown. Bombs go off in Bogota, Colombia, a day into a ceasefire. The United States goes to the World Trade Organization, trying to force Europeans to eat genetically engineered food. And radioactive particles may be in Afghanistan's air for another 4.5 billion years. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A U.S. district judge ruled today that on February 14th, he'll hear from a group of religious and educational leaders, including Ramsey Clark, who were suing on behalf of suspected Al-Qaeda and Taliban members now being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Lucia Chappell reports from Los Angeles.
They're charging that the treatment of the Afghan war captives violates the U.S. Constitution and Geneva Conventions. The group is petitioning for a writ of habeas corpus to demand that the suspects be formally charged in court. The petition also aims to stop the military from bringing any more captives to Guantanamo. On Monday, the total number of prisoners at Guantanamo reached 158, and military officials say more holding cells will be built for new arrivals in the next few days. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lucia Chappell in Los Angeles.
5 police officers were killed and 20 others were wounded today when 2 gun-toting motorcycle-riding men opened fire on a U.S. cultural center in Calcutta, India. There's lots of finger-pointing, but no conclusions about who is responsible. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Sputnik Kalambi reports on the incident.
Obviously, when incidents like this happen, immediately fingers are pointed at Pakistani-based militant groups. I mean, this time it was the Lashkar that was blamed. Though you had state authorities themselves saying almost immediately afterwards that it was actually a special police officer who had carried out the massacre. So it wasn't political, but there's so much killing that goes on here. You have domestic quarrels that have settled under the guise of militancy, and the killings are blamed on militants. And then you have, effectively what are domestic quarrels that are then given a political tinge and are currently in a charged atmosphere. That is the fear that any little thing could trigger something bigger.
That was Free Speech Radio News correspondent Sputnik Kalambi in India. Number 2 retail giant Kmart filed for bankruptcy protection today. Chris Giovannis has more from Chicago.
Discount retail giant Kmart filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in Chicago Tuesday morning, seeking relief from more than $4.7 billion in debt. Kmart employs roughly 250,000 workers at more than 2,100 stores in the United States. The company has said all stores are open, workers are being paid, and employee medical, dental, life insurance, disability, retirement, and other benefits are expected to continue without disruption. Susan Cowell, vice president of Unite, the union that represents 1,000 Kmart workers at clothing distribution sites, says the union is very concerned about the bankruptcy, which may jeopardize severance payments at 2 facilities scheduled to close before the bankruptcy was announced. Cowell says the union will closely monitor the employment status of Unite's remaining workers, seeking to preserve those jobs as best they can. This is Chris Giovannis reporting from the Chicago Independent Media Center for Free Speech Radio News.
A panel appointed by President Bush recommends paying United Airlines mechanics their raise, while the president continues his order barring the union from striking. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
A presidential panel has recommended to the White House that United Airlines mechanics receive their requested pay raise of 37%, which would bring the salaries in line with the mechanics at other major airlines. Bush had appointed the board last year during a so-called cooling-off period, essentially preventing the workers from striking for 60 days while the panel mediated the wage dispute. Frank Larkin, a communications representative for the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, disputed United's claim that the pay raise would financially disable the company.
They can't afford not to correct the wages of these mechanic and related employees. They're working at 1994 rates, and it represents an unbelievable advantage for the company to continue at that level.
The panel presented their report on Sunday at the end of the first half of the 60-day period. It is now up to United Airlines to accept or decline the findings of the panel, which, unlike arbitration, are non-binding. In Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
In a 7-2 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court deemed laws which keep sexual predators behind bars, even after they've served their sentences, legal. States with such laws must prove the offenders lack self-control, but did not say how they should prove it. Justice Antonin Scalia, in his dissent, called the ruling irresponsible. 19 states are holding more than 1,200 sex offenders because they're considered to be probable repeat offenders. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Colombian government has reached an agreement with rebel military forces to keep the country's beleaguered peace process alive. The agreement, announced by the government's peace commissioner and rebel leader Raul Reyes, was reached only hours before the government's midnight deadline. But as Rafael Kraft reports from Bogota, the ceasefire has already been broken.
4 people were killed and 6 electrical towers were blown up by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia a few hours after the Colombian government and the FARC gave themselves 80 days to sign a bilateral ceasefire, a move welcomed by international mediators as an opportunity to achieve peace. The FARC and the government agreed on Sunday to a timetable to silence their guns, in the first concrete achievement in 3 years of on-again, off-again peace talks aimed at ending a 38-year-old war that has killed 40,000 people in the past decade alone. As shown by yesterday's attack, obstacles lie ahead as the sides hammer out a definition of the ceasefire, particularly over whether it will include a pause in rebels' kidnappings of civilians and attacks on the country's infrastructure. Another obstacle are paramilitary forces, which are outlawed but unofficially supported by the government. Yesterday, paramilitary leader Carlos Castaño accused Pastrana in an email communique of selling out Colombia to the FARC and pledged to continue fighting the rebels. Sunday's accord also included studying how the government could crack down harder on paramilitaries who target rebels. Sunday's accord was a victory for Pastrana, who is struggling to base his legacy on delivering some peace to Colombia. Pastrana, whose 4-year term ends in August, cannot seek re-election. He had warned the FARC he would send the army to retake a demilitarized area he ceded to the rebels at the start of peace talks if they did not produce a ceasefire scheduled by midnight on Sunday. The FARC, which says it is fighting for socialist reforms in a country where more than half the population of 40 million people live below the poverty line, wants the government to suspend free market reforms and provide unemployment benefits. Political analysts said the ceasefire would be hard to maintain because of the wide dispersal of mobile guerrilla and paramilitary fronts operating in mountainous Colombia. Any chance clash with a military or paramilitary unit would trigger accusations rebels had violated the truce and could throw the peace process into a new crisis. Peace activists say the situation is made worse by U.S. involvement. The United States government is shipping $1 billion in mostly military aid to Colombia under the guise of fighting drugs. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rafael Kraft in Bogota.
The United States government, along with the biotech industry, is trying to force a European Union commission into relaxing regulations on genetically modified organisms. The United States government is threatening to use the World Trade Organization to force Europeans to accept the import of GMOs. From Copenhagen, Patrick Beckett reports.
The U.S. government outlined its concerns in a detailed memo sent to the EU Commission responsible for implementing strict regulations on genetically modified organisms. In the memo, the U.S. suggested the European regulations are incompatible with trade rules under the WTO. The new regulations outline a labeling and traceability scheme and establish the lowest possible threshold for the accidental contamination of seeds with GMOs. Jill Lacroix is biotechnology coordinator with Friends of the Earth, the group which obtained a copy of the confidential memo.
Wherever countries try to install fairly rigorous rules concerning genetically modified organisms and sort of GM-derived foods, so the next thing that we know, the United States is sort of stepping in, warning them not to do that, and making sort of threats of sanctions under the World Trade Organization.
The U.S. has recently used WTO trade rules to block proposed GMO regulations in Bolivia, Croatia, and Sri Lanka. But Western European citizens continue to resist genetically modified foods. An EU poll last month indicates that nearly 95% of European citizens want the right to choose through labeling and traceability laws. Again, Lacroix.
No one is saying shut the doors on U.S. imports. I mean that of course would be sort of an entirely different story. But I mean, European citizens don't want genetically modified soya or sort of corn or anything else. So you could also sort of ask the question, well, why don't American farmers give the Europeans what they want?
The U.S. position is that genetically engineered foods have already been tested and proved safe. In their memo to the EU Commission, the U.S. says that labeling foods which contain GMOs will erode consumer confidence without addressing safety concerns. Friends of the Earth and others say the U.S. is attempting to undermine Europe's democratic right to choose. But other environmental groups are also opposed to labeling GMOs. They argue that labeling is a way for GMOs to coexist with non-GM foods, and would prefer to see GMOs banned completely. For them, it is much more than an issue of safety.
And we say, as farmers, we say we don't need GMOs at all.
Gérard Choplin is with the European Farmers Coordination, an umbrella group of farmers for agricultural reform.
It's not just a question of safety. It's a question really on dependence on food. In a few years, if some multinational will now control seeds, control pesticides, will control all the chain for food, it's a question of democracy.
Choplin and others spend years fighting the WTO to protect a ban on bovine growth hormones and antibiotics in animal feed. They want the WTO to stay out of European agricultural policy.
So we don't trust at all the WTO to give clear and fair trade rules. We know who is writing the rules, and Monsanto is not very far from them.
In its memo, the U.S. government also claims the EU's traceability directive is unfeasible. They state that the level of GM proliferation is already so great that it is economically impossible to trace the origins of all agricultural products from field to market. The group Greenpeace warns that the EU Commission's failure to act quickly puts Europe at risk for more genetic contamination. They have issued a list of seed companies that can guarantee GMO-free seed. Greenpeace is urging the Commission to set a threshold for the contamination of seeds at the lowest possible detection level, 0.1%. The biotech industry is fighting for a higher contamination level. Lorenzo Consoli is GMO advisor with Greenpeace.
To put the Europeans in face of a fait accompli. Once the contamination is there, you have to accept it, you cannot do anything anymore. This is what we want to avoid. We think that it is possible to have a very low threshold corresponding to the detection level, 0.1%.
This is Patrick Beckett in Copenhagen for Free Speech Radio News.
While the bombing of Afghanistan seems to be ending, the impacts of the ongoing conflict in that country will likely be felt for years to come. Speculation is rising that depleted uranium weapons were very likely used in Afghanistan. Shells loaded with depleted uranium are the choice of the U.S. and British military because of their armor-piercing capability. On impact, they leave tiny particles of radioactive dust that settles in the environment and becomes a long-lasting hazard to the ecosystem and human health. Free Speech Radio News' Charles Michael Ray has this story on the use of depleted uranium weapons and what activists and scientists are saying about the impact of their previous use in Yugoslavia and Iraq, and now possibly in Afghanistan.
Cancer rates are skyrocketing, and severe deformities in newborns continue to show up in areas of Iraq and former Yugoslavia, countries where U.S. and British warplanes drop depleted uranium bombs on cities and front lines. Many fear that Afghanistan will soon follow with a large increase of cancer rates and health problems around bombed-out areas. A conference on depleted uranium weapons in Prague brought together scientists and activists from across Europe and North America. Dr. Chris Busby, an environmental scientist with the European Committee on Radiation Risk, is researching the effects of depleted uranium, or DU, on human health. Busby explains that when a shell containing DU hits a target, it vaporizes into tiny dust-sized particles that can then become airborne and lodge in lung tissue to cause cancer. The Department of Defense says that the radiation from depleted uranium is not sufficient enough to cause cancer, and that it is safely used as a ballast in ships and aircraft. But Busby contends that U.S. officials are basing their opinions on bad science. He says the U.S. is using models that predict cancer rates from a large, single, outside source of radiation, but not looking at the health hazard caused by dust-sized radioactive particles.
It's not possible or not correct to use a sort of external model when, in fact, you've inhaled a particle and it's just burning away inside you at one point. And now it's time to say, well, this model is old-fashioned and it has to be chucked out. And I believe in the next 5 years we'll see that. But the problem now is, of course, if we chuck the model out, we're going to have massive litigation because all the people who have been poisoned as a result of this model are going to come along and say, hey, look, my daughter died of leukemia because she lived near Sellafield. You told us it was safe.
Depleted uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Busby says DU particles from exploded ordnance settle in the environment and remain a serious hazard for an unknown period of time, while the U.S. government contends that DU dust will be washed away after a hard rain. Busby says he has measured dangerous levels of DU near shelled-out tanks in Iraq 10 years after the Gulf War. Meanwhile, newspaper reports from Pakistan claim that U.S. warplanes have attacked Afghanistan with depleted uranium weapons, and many say that the Afghan people will be next on the list of those suffering from radiation poisoning. The U.S. Department of Defense still denies that DU shells were used in Afghanistan, but Marianne Kupko, with an NGO working to abolish nuclear weapons, points out that the U.S. denied DU was used in Kosovo until long after the war ended.
Depleted uranium is a weapon of mass destruction. I'm convinced that they use it the same way in Afghanistan, like they used it in other countries like Iraq, Kosovo, or Serbia, and Somalia. And I'm very concerned about the people who are living there, especially the children who are the most sensitive to radiation. And yeah, just by knowing how much the cancer rate increased in Iraq, it's just unbelievable because it's definitely a genocide what's going on there, and it has to be stopped.
Nearly 1 million DU shells were used in Iraq during the Gulf War. Parts of southern Iraq have been laid waste and made uninhabitable due to DU radiation. Mike Smolik with the National Coalition to Stop the War in Iraq says the U.S. government needs to be brought to task on the hazards of DU.
I think there's considerable evidence that at least in the United States, there's something of a cover-up. That is to say that we have documents from the Pentagon, from the military itself, recognizing the dangers of depleted uranium, published prior to and shortly after the Gulf War. And yet we're hearing from the Pentagon and NATO officially that there's no danger. So it's partly a propaganda battle to get the word out about the dangers of depleted uranium.
Scientists like Dr. Chris Busby warn that not only the Afghan people, but soldiers and relief workers in Afghanistan need to be very cautious of the effects of DU particles that may be left behind in bombed and shelled areas. As America continues its war on terrorism, the people of Afghanistan could be facing a different terror, having the very air they breathe and the water they drink poisoned by particles of radioactive dust. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Prague.
Pro-choice and anti-abortion supporters came out today in Washington to mark the 29th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. Anti-abortion advocates held vigils for the death of what they call unborn children, while applauding the recent efforts of the Bush administration to institute a National Sanctity of Human Life Day. Meanwhile, pro-choice advocates worry that the protections guaranteed by Roe v. Wade may be dismantled under the Bush administration. Kata Mester has more from Washington.
Just days before the 29th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, President Bush declared January 20th to be National Sanctity of Human Life Day.
Pro-lifers are proud to have a man like President Bush in the White House.
Susan Stanmeyer is a spokeswoman for National Right to Life.
His election in 2000 was a giant step forward. This year and the next year and the year after next, we will continue to move forward. And eventually we will succeed. unborn children will once again be welcomed in life and protected in law.
On Bush's first day in office, he revoked support for international reproductive rights programs, reinstating the so-called global gag rule. Supporters of a woman's right to choose also say Bush has stacked his administration with individuals hostile to the pro-choice stance, like Attorney General John Ashcroft. And then there's the Supreme Court. Kate Mishelman of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League.
One more nominee hostile to a woman's right to choose, and our freedom will be lost, and millions of women will be subjected then to the ravages of illegal abortion.
In 2000, the Supreme Court nearly overturned the Roe v. Wade decision with the Stenberg v. Carhart case. With a 5-4 decision in the Carhart case, the Supreme Court struck down a Nebraska law banning a broad range of abortion procedures. Rosemary Dempsey, Director of Government Relations for the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy.
Roe's been attacked ever since 1973, and, you know, we can talk about that whole history. But what happened there was it was a decision not just based on that procedure, but the very central element of who decides a woman's health. And what that decision, 5-4, one vote short, said is that a woman's health is still central.
Unable to make all abortion illegal, anti-choice legislators have continued to try to make abortion services difficult for many women to obtain. One way anti-choice lawmakers have done this is by singling out abortion for exclusion from health care plans that cover other pregnancy-related care. According to one study, low-income women on average need twice as much time to raise the necessary funds than do middle or upper-income women. Almost half of the women who obtain abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy were delayed by problems obtaining abortion services. Anti-choice forces also impose burdensome regulations on abortion clinics, ostensibly out of concern for women's health. Recently, South Carolina imposed new abortion facility regulations that require corridors and doorways to be a specified width, mandate lab tests that are not medically indicated for every woman, and require that the building temperature remain within a certain range. Meanwhile, a campaign of violence, vandalism, and terrorism curtails the availability of abortion services. Since 1993, three doctors, two clinic employees, a clinic escort, and a security guard have been murdered. There have been 17 attempted murders on abortion clinic staff since 1991. Gloria Felt, president of Planned Parenthood, says, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, a woman will lose a lot more than just her freedoms to have an abortion.
It's no surprise that the legal basis of Roe is the same legal basis that gave us the right to get birth control, the right to privacy, and that the same people who oppose a woman's right to choose abortion are also the people who vote very frequently against family planning funds. They vote against responsible and medically accurate sexuality education. They are the people who are pouring hundreds of millions of federal and state dollars into abstinence-only sex education that is completely useless and unproven.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Kata Mester.
An oil pipeline fire, which has been burning in Nigeria's Niger Delta region for the past 3 months, has caused serious ecological damage. As the fire rages on, there's little hope that local communities affected by the disaster will be compensated by the multinational oil company, Shell Petroleum, which owns the pipeline. Sam Olukoya has the details from Nigeria.
Of all the communities affected by the pipeline fire, Barale is the worst hit. The stage for the disaster was set 7 months ago when an oil pipeline, which belongs to the Anglo-Dutch oil company Shell, ruptured at a point where it passes near the community. The crude oil flowed into the community and nearby farmlands and forests. Young Aseme, who lives near the pipeline, says he had to abandon his home because it was flooded with crude oil.
The oil entered inside my house and all our clothes and all everything were damaged by the spillage.
4 months after the pipeline started leaking, there was a fire outbreak. Aseme Umbani says the fire started with a loud explosion, which shook the entire area and sent everyone running away.
We were in the house around 10 o'clock. We heard a sound, like sound of gun, explosion. Sound, boom. Every place shake. But we come out, we see very highly smoke. And the fire immediately rushed into the community because the pipelines are along the community.
The crude oil from the leaking pipeline has kept the fire burning in the last 3 months. It has left a lot of damage in its wake. Young Aseme is now homeless. His house and property were burnt.
Up till now, we are suffering. All my property, all my house is damaged. So I don't have anywhere to stay again as I'm here.
Farmlands and forests have also been burnt down. The air smells of crude oil, while a cloud of dark smoke covers the area. Residents complain of skin problems apparently caused by acid rain. They also say they suffer cough and respiratory ailments because of smoke from the fire. This old man says in the last 3 months, he inhaled a lot of smoke from the fire. He says he fainted a couple of times because he has developed breathing problems. Residents of the area say they have appealed to the oil company Shell, which owns the pipeline, to put out the fire. Young Aseme said Shell officials refused to act, accusing the community of deliberately causing the disaster.
He went to meet the Shell people to come and quench it. They refused. They said we should suffer, that we are the doer of the thing, that we should suffer before they will come.
But Shell says its workers cannot go to the disaster area because the communities are hostile to them. Shell accuses the communities of deliberately causing the disaster in order to get compensation. The company has ruled out compensation to affected communities. Shell and other Western oil companies like Chevron and ExxonMobil operating in the Niger Delta do not pay compensation to local communities for damages resulting from their operations, under the excuse that such damages were the result of sabotage in local communities. The Nigerian government granted the oil companies this unusual privilege. Environmentalist and human rights lawyer Orunto Douglas says this is unfair because the government and the oil companies determine what is sabotage without any input from the local communities.
The communities and the people are not involved in the definition of sabotage. They are not involved in the processes of determining sabotage. They are only called in to be told that this act was an act of sabotage. And in 101% of the situation, if you want to elongate it, they have always denied and insisted that they are not part and parcel of this destructive act that the companies and the government have termed sabotage.
Most times, what the government and the oil companies term sabotage are in fact the result of the poor safety standards of the companies. For Runto Douglas, a situation where damage emanating from the poor safety standards of the oil companies is blamed on local communities has only served to protect the interests of the multinational oil companies to the detriment of local communities and their environment.
The issue here is not about protecting the people. It is not about protecting the environment. It's not about protecting the entire humanity. It is about protecting corporate profit, especially as it is rooted in the oil industry.
Corporate profit for the oil industry also means profit for the Nigerian government. The government and the oil companies almost exclusively share oil profits to the exclusion of local communities. Vast areas in the Niger Delta lay in ruins as a result of oil spills and fires from the facilities of Western oil companies operating there. In the quest for profit, no compensation is paid to affected communities under the guise that the communities sabotage. Barale community will suffer the same fate. The Nigerians saying that oil is a cause has become only too true for communities in the country's Niger Delta region. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Barale, Nigeria.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 140 reporters around the world are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. I'm Larry Bensky, sitting in for Verna Avery Brown.
I'm Scott Gurian in New Jersey, and I report for Free Speech Radio News because it's the best hard-hitting alternative news source on the radio. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.